one, sir. And what is your name, sir?
David Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart, for being here this morning before the Arizona Board of Executive Committee. And at this time, the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson will be the lead for your hearing. So we're going to ask if you just hold on while he gets his paperwork together, and we will be ready to move forward, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, sir. I'm going to introduce you to the board members that will be conducting your hearing this morning. To my far left is the Honorable Luis Quinones. Coming down the line from there is the Honorable David Neal. In the middle, we have the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who is our board chair. To my immediate left is the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse. And my name is Michael Johnson, sir. I'm going to be acting as your lead during the hearing today, sir. So I'm going to go over some information that we have, and then I'm going to give you the opportunity to go. If you are appearing before this board for an absolute discharge, regular parole, or home arrest, is that right, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You are currently serving a life sentence for rape, is that right?
Yes, sir.
This incident occurred back in September of 1972, where you forced your way inside of the victim's residence. You threatened to kill the young child that she had that came outside, a little boy, and if he didn't go back into his room. And as a result of it, you wind up in the process of having sexual assault with the rape of the victim, who was on her period at the time, and she told you that she was on a menstrual cycle. And after she told you that she was on a menstrual cycle, you did tell her to remove the tampon, and then you had sex with her. After having sex with her, you then left the residence. Is that about right, sir?
I've been told that over and over, and I don't remember any four-year-old child. I don't deny what that happened. I was intoxicated, but there's that aspect of the crime that I don't recall. As far as everything else that you mentioned, I agree to that.
Okay, what do you recall, sir? In your words, what?
I recall that I first went in to a 21-year-old woman's home, and I subjected her to terror by forcing her to rape her, and
okay. So were you just overly intoxicated when this incident occurred, sir?
I was very intoxicated when this occurred.
Okay.
I had been out bar hopping.
Okay. And it says that I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
That's the justification, but I mean those were the facts that existed at that time.
Okay. And according to the progress report, sir, it looks like you haven't had any tickets since 2005, and you actually had very minimal citations since you've been incarcerated. You had 8 minors and 2 majors. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you actually have appeared before this board for parole hearings 60 times, about 60 times. You were granted parole 412A, which is regular parole, back in November of 1986, and that was revoked in January of 1993. And then you were later in 2002 granted home arrest which was revoked in 2004. Is that about right, sir?
No, that's not accurate. I was granted parole in 88 and was out of parole for 4.5 years, and then I was violated and reincarcerated. In 2002, I was paroled. Prior to my release, I was taken to the state hospital for a possible commitment. On November the 14th of 2003, I was ordered released by the Superior Court. I was found by three forensic psychiatrists not to meet the requirements for SVP. On July the 27th of 2004, I was re-violated.
Okay.
And that's... But I've never been out of home arrest.
Okay, so I see that according to the documentation that I have, it does show that you, and it was my error, that it was not a home arrest, that you were granted a 412A, which is regular parole. It looks like on here, November 7th of 02, you were granted regular parole, and then it looks like that was revoked in November 2004. The dates may be a little bit off, but you're correct in what you're saying about the parole. Now, sir, according to the information that we have, and one time while you were out on parole, you got into another incident. Did you go where you were stalking a female, allegedly stalking a female?
That's when I was violated on July the 27th.
Okay.
I was violated actually for two parking tickets and for trying to engage in a relationship without prior approval from my parole officer. However, that engaging into a relationship elevated to a stalking, and so I was violated. At that time, I never had any police contact. I was asked to come into the parole office, and I met with my parole officer, which was Steve Butcher at the time, and his supervisor, Mr. Scully. Mr. Scully was going to put me on home arrest. I mean, on, what do you call that? The ankle bracelet?
Yeah, home arrest.
And my parole officer asked to talk with him for a few minutes. And when I was asked to come back in, I was violated for the two tickets and engaging in a relationship. Once I got to the police jail, then it had taken on stalking. I had one encounter with this person at this apartment complex that I worked at every Friday. A fellow employee had asked me to ask her how much the rent was at that particular place. It was the Apache Boulevard Apartments, and so that's when I engaged in a conversation with her, which lasted for approximately 20 to 25 minutes. The guy that asked me to ask her couldn't speak English, so I was translating the questions he had about the facility, and then her and I got into a conversation, she was from Chicago, new to the state. She had been here very long, her and her boyfriend, and we talked about the weather in Arizona. I told her I had a brochure from the Grand Chamber of Commerce that had all these different places that she talked about sightseeing, and I offered it to her. I told her that I could drop it by and she could look at that and decide on some of the places to visit. On that particular evening, I went to my daughter's house which is up on Baseline and 24th. And so that was the area that I went to, what's it called? Some store, Burlington's, to buy some khakis. I had the brochure in my truck, and so I drove by the apartment after I came out of Burlington's and to drop it off. And when I got there, I went to knock on the door. No one was there. I went to the apartment across the hers, because it was up on the top floor. And I was going to leave it off the floor. Nobody else was there. And as I was coming back down the steps, I met with this guy who asked me, you know, what I was doing on the property. And I told him that I was there to drop off this brochure for Megan. He said, there's no way you're around here, so I left. And on Sunday, I was at my daughter's, and I drove by there after I left to see if I saw her. I dropped off the brochure. Again, I met with this guy, and he followed me in my car. And so I thought, I'll just go to the company truck, and if I see her when I'm there on Friday smoking, I'll just drop it off and give it to her. So it led up in the company truck, was there. That's where my parole officer found him. It was alleged that I was there like 1 o'clock at 9 or 1:30, I can't remember. And I was there like somewhere between 9 and 9:30. I asked my parole officer if he look at the video tapes, because they record that. I knew that because I worked there. I cleaned the parking lots there. And that was never done. But just to show him what time I was at that place. My parole officer, in his assessment of whether or not he was going to violate me, said that I had to suffer a consequence. That I put the fear, there's people that are afraid of me. The consequences that she had to suffer was to move. She didn't feel safe there, so she had to move. So I had to suffer a consequence. And so he said, you know, you'll go back for 2 years, but it won't be long. So that was the brunt of that whole violation process. Now, with that said, I've gone through 12 years of treatment. There's 11 letters in my, I hope that you have that before you, of my treatment evolution. And, you know, since my going into treatment and surrendering to understand why I would put myself in these type of situations, I had to do self-searching. And so having gone through treatment, I think one of the most significant things I've learned out of treatment is to have empathy. That's kind of like a new feeling for me. It's my awareness of empathy helps me to understand from your perspective, specifically you, Mr. Thomas, because you made a point last time I saw you that you're concerned for this girl. You know what, if somebody approached my daughter like that, I would have the same sense to have this guy locked up and confronted. That's a new awareness for me, to look at it from that perspective. I grew up, you know, thinking that the police officers were pigs, and, my opinion of that has changed dramatically. The people I serve, they keep my family safe. So I have a different appreciation for law enforcement and a different appreciation for the parole system. If I were to use my parole officer as a support, I wouldn't be in this situation right now. I wouldn't be where I have to explain myself. I hope that you'll take the time to read the letters that have been written about my commitment to treatment. It's the best decision I ever made to get into treatment. I utilize everything that I've learned about that program in my everyday life. It has helped me to stay away from drugs. Has even helped me to give up smoking and to think healthy, to keep myself, my mind, body, and spirit healthy. I'm always aware of being aware of my surroundings, of my decisions. I challenge myself all the time, and I continue to stay involved in the maintenance program. So I've committed myself to treatment, and it's also what I want to do outside of here if I should ever have the privilege of regaining my freedom. Because I would like to be in that therapeutic environment. I'd like to be doing what I do now, and that's help other guys, giving them insight and helping them from the observations I make and from the mistakes I've made.
So
I'm not the same person. I'm sorry.
So you have been in custody. You have been out twice, that you were paroled to get out twice, and each time you was revoked and you went back to prison. On occasion, there's two occasions that one of them where you tried to give the female the pamphlet. There was another one where you were knocking on someone's door, and the officer stated that it led to stalking because you had seen this female before, and that she had to call her neighbor from next door because she was afraid, because she was knocking on her door at 1:30 in the morning, which is kind of the similar MO of the sexual assault that you committed, sir. So those are the things, and I know that since you've been incarcerated, you've done some good things, and you do have a good report since you've been incarcerated, but the times that you were released, you prohibited the same type of behavior that led to the sexual assault, which you were incarcerated for.
Yeah, that was two separate incidents. That was the same incidents. So there were two separate incidents, but I understand what you're saying. The distinction is that I didn't have the understanding that I have now. I hadn't had any treatment experience at that time. I'm not that same person. I'm not the person that I consider all my decisions now are based on the things that are important to me. I define my values, and one of those values is my family and freedom. So if I value my family and I value freedom, then every decision that I make from this day on is going to be based on my family and on freedom and on my integrity. I wasn't that kind of person when I was out all these other times.
So you're saying that now you...
What is that distinction?
So you're saying that now, you know, you value your family and you value freedom. But prior to that, you didn't value family and freedom because you had your freedom on two separate occasions. And I think you should have known how important that was, because on the first occasion that you were released, they tried to rescind it and you wound up going to court. And the judge ordered them, because they let you out on parole, and then one of the board members wanted to rescind it because he had second thoughts, and then they held a recession hearing and tried to put you back to not release you. It went to court, and it was challenged, and the court ordered them to release you. So I would think that from that first time that you would have known how important your freedom was, sir.
Yeah, I can understand that. You would think, but I didn't, and I don't feel that. I mean, I'm ashamed to have to say that, but I didn't. I was too arrogant, and I was too in thinking I was entitled, that I beat the system, to even, regard it as something that of value. I'm a 66-year-old man that has, my thinking has evolved as well. I don't know how many more years I have, but I do know that I am very clear I didn't even know what a value was before. I thought a value was just something that you got in a store. But I'm clear about the things that are important to me now. I'm clear about how I want to be remembered. This is not how I want to be remembered as somebody in orange, a prisoner. I want to be remembered as somebody who contributed, somebody that was a good citizen. And that's what I focused on these last 12 years is becoming a good citizen.
Okay. So I don't see if the board has any additional questions for you. Some more additional questions from the... Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Rittenhouse. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Stewart, part of our responsibility is to assess. We each come from different backgrounds. In our opinion, whether someone who is a candidate for parole will be successful in the community and probably more importantly be a danger to the community. And on the previous occasion when you were out in 2002, I think it was, you, as Mr. Johnson just said, you engaged in the same type of behavior by pounding on the woman's door that you had when you committed your crime. Now, that was in 2004, and you completed your treatment in 2008. So if Robert Stewart was out on the street now, in that same situation, how would your behavior be different because of your treatment? What would you do differently?
Well, first of all, I would get myself in that situation. Know how to escape certain situations and know how to avoid certain situations. Those are very cognizant for me now.
What's an example? Can you give an example of that? What you mean?
Let's see. What would be a good example? If I saw, I'm going towards a location that I have to get to, and as I'm going to that location, several girls soliciting on that particular street. Well, I would go out of my way to avoid any kind of contact or being in that vicinity and going around the wrong way to get to my destination. But I have to be constantly cognizant of my environment and the places I'm at. Here's another example. If I went to a restaurant and I have to go to the restroom, and I get up to walk towards the restroom, and I see a couple of kids walk in there, I would go back and sit down and wait till the restroom became clear. I don't want to be in a situation that, would even give the appearance of any wrongdoing. Although I don't have any crimes against children, I have to constantly think about the environment, I have to constantly think about how is this going to look in the long run. It's what I do here. If I get the sense that there's some kind of, disturbance or guys acting out, I get away from that environment. I go to my door. I don't want to be associated with that. Before I even think from that perspective. So that's one thing that I've been exercising for the longest time now.
Okay, so thank you. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Okay. So there's a letter in here with a strong objection from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. It also indicates in the letter that when you were interviewed by the Probation Department, that you stated that from the age of 12 to 18, you were involved in window peeping, but you were never caught. In addition, you had a fetish of smelling women's underclothes for 7 years. Is that right? Do you recall telling them that?
No, that's false. When is that letter dated? May 29th.
It is dated, we received the letter, the letter is dated May 29th of 2018.
Is there any way I can have a copy of that letter?
Sure. You could work with your CO3 and get a copy of this letter. It also indicates in the letter, sir, that during the interview with the probation officer it states that you had previously been arrested for rape in July of 1971. The charge was reduced, and then you were released on June 5th of 1972 after serving 1 year in jail. Then in July of 1972, you were arrested for 3 counts of rape with the same victim. You were found not guilty by a jury on 2 counts and was released on your own reconnaissance on September 13, 1972. Then shortly after your release, you were arrested for the current offense that you incarcerated for. And there's a history of the sexual of you being involved in rape, and it just continues. And then my concern is, one of my bigger concerns is that you say that you had treatment, but in the current incident that you're involved in, you said that you were very intoxicated when you participated in that activity. However, it appears that when you were out on parole and you participated in similar type of activity by stalking or knocking on a female's door, as you say you wanted to give her some material, there's no indication that you were intoxicated at that time, but you exhibited the same type of behavior, sir. So it's alcohol or
anything? Yeah. All this that you're talking about, I can only respond to, have been 12 years in treatment. So if those 12 years in treatment don't mean anything, if the board doesn't, think that the treatment is even significant, I don't understand how, we pay several dollars to provide a treatment program, and at some point, we have to see whether or not it's even working.
Right.
Statistics show that treatment and supervision have been very, very successful. There's a high percentage of success and a low recidivism rate because of this combination of things. But, I can't sit here and defend all my past lives before everybody to see. I can only speak on what I have done for myself to address my external thinking and to become the best person that I can be. And I've done that. I'm I believe a model inmate, under the statutes that specifically says that I'm not sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. There's a distinction between life with the possibility and life without the possibility. So at this moment, I'm taking a position that there never be any possibility, that there's never going to be anything that's going to change me, then, you're talking about 60 times I've been to this Ecuadorian people. I'm focused on becoming the best person I can be, and also being a valued citizen. I think I have a lot to offer in terms of helping others, and also being an asset that would help the vulnerable victims. And I value that. And I wish that this board would look at it from that perspective. For me, seeing you go back and you know, there's all these things that I can't ever change. They don't ever be changed. The only thing that could change is how I think. And I don't know that there's too many inmates that would invest 12 years of treatment. It's not enough trying to get guys into treatment these days because there's such a resistance the way the process is. But I volunteered for treatment 12 years ago, and I stayed committed to that, and I wish that would really speak on my character today. And all these bad decisions that I made, that there would be some balance to where I am at now. Today is my life.
Okay. Okay, so you do have a supporter here. Your brother Gilbert Stewart is here, and we're going to have Mr. Stewart speak at this time. If you would just come up to the mic, sir, and state your name and present the information that you'd like to present to the board.
My name is Gilbert Stewart. I want to thank the board for giving me this opportunity to say something about my brother. I want to say that he does have the support of the family. We have a large family. We lost our parents and our grandparents, but it's our siblings. He also has children and grandchildren, which he's never really ever seen to this day. I know that we continually speak with him. We talk to him at least every 2 weeks. He calls, and we talk about what's going on with the family and such. I know that when speaking to our elders, which there are very few of them left, they are always asking for him and supporting him, which the family will do if he is granted clemency, and also support making his, to stick into his character. I know he's very adamant about continue treatment and also helping other people. From what I understand, and being and visiting with him, that he is a very big mentor to a lot of them that go there. He's a facilitator. He's also done this for many years, and he's a changed person from when you speak of all these old times. Totally different person altogether. But it just seems like it just rolls back around, and you have to talk about it again. Misunderstandings about this, the situation that happened with this stalking, it changed from annoying to stalking, and then always receiving a letter from the Attorney General's office a few days before he's supposed to come up. It makes me wonder if there's just something there that's going to, because it's happened before. The first parole board meeting that I've gone to for him, they had it the same thing. It was like a week before. or 2 days. And I don't know if there's something that just continually processes that comes up every time it does this, but it's from what I can say for the family, though, we are in full support of him. We all have our little jobs that we do. I know that he does a lot of writing. He's had about 6 publications of poems and artwork that he does. Now, that's what I do. I'm an artist. I have a embroidery and screen printing business that I've had for many years. But I've also signed for Social Security. I'm 67. I'm only 1 year older than him. And I know from the heartbreak that we had to go through losing our mother, who was raised 8 kids, 7 boys and 1 girl, and how close-knit we all are towards each other. Now that they're gone, it's just us, and I'm the eldest. So I only can speak for them if necessary. You know, my elders will write letters, whatever needs to be done. You know how I am. I was here yesterday, which I got wrong, but I'm here today to stand with him and to let you know that the family does stand with him. And I appreciate you giving me two days to do this, but that's pretty much the top of everything. It's just, he does have support.
So his brother, James Stewart?
Yes, my brother Jim.
Okay, that's who he wants to stay with.
My brother Jim would have been here too, but he had a stroke in Thanksgiving. It was in July, and then he had a seizure. He had to be put in the hospital. He's a big guy. He's a truck driver. So he just started moving again. He got another job again. He's moving around again. So I know that he plans, but he's... It's funny, since he had the stroke, he's a little bit more eased. His temper has changed. So it's kind of like, I don't know if he'd come in here and start, you know, I'm the more calmest of all the brothers. My brother and my brother David. My brother would come in here, he's Army, he's a lifer Army, Armor Division, and we're all military vets. And I wouldn't put it past him if someone would say something and he would go off his head. And obviously I'd be sitting there squirming because I don't know what he would be saying. But we all love each other very much. We care a lot about Bob. I know he's had a scare with cancer. We don't really know too much about that. But I know that he does have the support of the living elders and his family. It's just sad that my mom's not here, because she was the one that was always there for all of us. And but I would hope and pray that you would grant him clemency, and to know that we have his back.
Okay. Sir, are you the brother that was with him the night that this incident occurred?
Yes, I was the one that was driving us home, and I had a 66 Chevelle Super Sport when I just came back from the service. And of course, it stopped on us in the middle of the road. He was scared because he said, well, this is what's going to happen. They're going to pull up on us. We're in a neighborhood. So I said, don't go. Just sit here and wait. And he says, no. He was totally afraid of the police department. And he had an attitude. You can even hear him when he said what he thought of police officers. Well, going through this whole life of his life that he had, he didn't really much care for him. Me, it was different. I went in the service to serve my country with Vietnam, and I wish that he could have come along too. But when one leaves, it runs down who takes the man of the house, because it was just my mom. So that's how we all time. But when he ran, it was like me, please tell me. And then, I am all for police officers, but there are a few. And I was subjected to racial, actually saying that I was going to be charged with a raid, because I wouldn't give him up. I just said, oh, he was just a hitchhiker, I guess. You know, no, we know about you, you know. And I had also had family friends that were police officers, so my view on that was totally different, especially just coming back from the service, you know. But he ran, and when he left, they took me and put me under the gun as far as being interrogated and then threatened and all the little things that they do. So to the point where I said, well, we're going to charge you. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's not me. Well, we're going to charge you. And I said, who was it? I said, it was my brother. Well, we knew it was your brother. We just wanted you to say it. So they let me out and had to walk all the way back to North Phoenix from downtown. But then I heard about how they came and got him, and my mom was just totally upset about the whole thing. But I was a brother that was driving him home at that time.
Okay. So first of all, let me thank you for your service too. I want to make sure that I do get that in. I do want to see if the board has any additional questions for you. Okay, send no additional questions from the board. Sir, I do want to thank you for taking the time to come up here. Is there anything else you had, sir?
No, I just appreciate the 2 days I got.
Well, okay.
You'll remember me the next time.
I'd like to see you the next time.
So. You're welcome to come down as many times as
that's
you want.
Well, Dr. Wright said I could go ahead. Well, you can stay if you want.
It's
okay. I'll just see you tomorrow.
We'll get your bed.
Thank you very much.
But just don't come on Fridays. You've never heard of
it. That's what odd, because normally it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday. So I thought, well, it's not Tuesday, so it's got to be a Wednesday. And then I'm trying to work in between going to the gym and, you know, skipping my day and you know, take care of the families and stuff, you know, make sure that they're all calling me. I'll get phone calls after this, and, you know, from all family members to see how he is and stuff. And we have another elder that's not doing too well right now, so, you know, he's concerned about that. But we are consistently in contact with him, and, you know, it's sad that he can't be with his family, you know. His own kids, his own grandkids, he's never even seen them. So it's, but I leave it in your hands, and I appreciate the time that you gave me to come and speak to you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You brothers sure do look alike. I mean, I'm seeing you and him behind you on the wall.
I'm seeing my mom, actually.
Just like my mom, you know, so.
But thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Stewart, the board's coming up on a conclusion of your hearing, sir. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the board without repeating yourself?
I just, at the least, if you just give me an opportunity for unrest and let me, you know, prove myself and come back to you and hopefully get General Perrell to give me that opportunity. I won't let you down. I would utilize every thing I've learned in the 12 years of treatment. One other thing, and finally, I suffer from life-threatening disease, and I didn't deny treatment here in prison, and I would hope to have that opportunity to address that once I'm released. So that will be my focus, my immediate focus is to go through treatment for Hep C. And with that, I leave you with your decision.
Okay. All right, Mr. Stewart, the board's going to go into discussion. So while the board's in discussion, I'm going to ask you to remain silent while the board's in discussion. You'll be able to hear the discussion taking place. After the discussion, the board will make a decision whether to whether to deny or grant you parole. The board's in discussion. At this time, Mr. Stewart, you just remain silent while the board's in discussion, sir.
Okay.
We've had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Stewart before. Mr. Stewart has been, and in the end, has taken many classes that he's been in. He's been a model type prisoner since he's been incarcerated. We do have to take all of those things in consideration. Along with taking those things in consideration, one of the biggest things that we have to take into consideration is that there's a strong likelihood that the defendant would not reoffend if he was released. And I'm just not convinced, based on his past, because he was the history of what happened is that during his first parole hearing, there were three board members. Two of them voted to grant him parole. One of them voted not to. The board member had it was uncomfortable with it after giving them more thought, and they decided to hold a recession hearing. Make a long story short, they did have a recession hearing. It was time they revoked it. And then it went to court, and the court basically stated that, you know, the board, the only way that they could rescind his hearing is that they had to revoke him, and he had to commit a violation for him to revoke him. And he was released out and a custody, and he had his freedom at that time. He subsequently wound up violating that and was taken back into custody. And then, you know, over 10 years later, he was released again. And when he was released the second time, he exhibited the same types of behavior as when he committed the first crime. And he subsequently was revoked and put back in prison. And, you know, has taken some training and been a model citizen during that period of time. And according to the information and the county attorney's report that he had had prior to all of this happening, he had previous arrests for rape. The one he's in, he said that he was intoxicated at the time, which is why he did it. The other one, he was not intoxicated, but it was almost the same, exhibited the same behavior that it was. I'm just not comfortable that. I don't know what triggers him to want to get involved in that type of activity or what that trigger point is, but I am not comfortable that Mr. Stewart would not reoffend if he was released, and if that would trigger and that would happen again. However, that's my opinion as a board member, but I'm willing to listen to the rest of my colleagues. Mr. Kenyans.
I have to say that one of my general, thank you, sir, one of my general concerns is that his revocations were around the ages of 40 and 50. He was a middle-aged man at the time. I would think that his freedom would mean a lot to him after that much time in the correction system. And that pattern of revocation plus his history is just uncomfortable for me. I can't find more words for it than that. Thank you, sir.
Ms. Rittenhouse.
Well, I do believe that treatment is effective. And he participated in a lot of treatment. I'm really troubled by that, the 2004 incident. And I know that was before the treatment. But I'm still really troubled by that. So I think I'm troubled by that continued behavior.
Ms. Neff.
The other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, when you were talking about the letter from the county attorney, and Mr. Stewart said he didn't remember it and that it was untrue, the county attorney got the information from the pre-sentence report that was written in 1972 after he pled guilty. And it was page 9, and it was a statement he made to the writer of the pre-sentence report, and it pretty much verbatim what was in the county attorney's letter. So whether it happened or not, I can't say, but he did make statements in 1972 that he was a peeping Tom, that he'd done that other. There are things that he denied when he was reading his letter. Thank you.
You have any comments?
I have no comments.
So therefore, I am going to make a motion to deny Mr. Stewart home arrest, regular parole, or an absolute discharge. That would be my motion.
Second.
Second by Mr. Quinones.
Agree.
Agree, Ms. Rittenhouse.
Agree.
Agree, Mr. Neal.
Agree.
And agree, Dr. Wright. Because of the time that it happens, not eligible for a one-year set-off, the release type denied is regular parole, home arrest, or an absolute discharge. The reasons for it is that, I'm going to mark it as a serious and violent offense. I'm going to mark it as a serious legal offense. Trauma to the victim. I'm going to mark history of assault, of assaultive behavior, prior criminal history. I'm also going to mark a repeat offender. Was release plan, it simply just stated that release from prison, he was going to reside with James Floyd's brother
and Social Security.
Yeah, and receive Social Security. So he does have family support, as stated by his brother, that is here. So those are going to be the reasons for denial, unless the board has some others that they'd like to include. Okay. So Mr. Stewart?
Yes.
Sir, the board has voted to deny your regular parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge at this time, sir. Did you hear the reasons for denial, sir?
Yes, I've got serious nature of offense, trauma to the victim, history of assaultive behavior, repeat offender, and there was one more, what was it?
Prior criminal history.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
All right, sir, that's going to conclude your hearing at this time, Mr. Stewart. I want to thank you for taking the time and opportunity for participating in your hearing today. Thank you, sir.
Great.
Would you put the CO3 on the phone, though?